My name is Anne Umland. I'm a curator in the Department of Painting and Sculpture, and I'm pleased to have the opportunity to introduce our second panel of the day and the last one of the symposium, dedicated or devoted to the topic of the institutionalization of feminism. I think before we get started, just a quick reminder of the format, which is that after I introduce the speakers, they'll each make a brief presentation. We'll all come up on stage, and then we'll move directly to questions from the audience. Although we very much regret that Salah Hassan was unable to join us at the last minute, we are pleased, to the extent one can be pleased, by the opportunity it presents. We hope to have an opportunity for questions after Linda Nochlin's response, in addition to questions after this panel. So, with no further ado, it is my pleasure and privilege to introduce, in the order they'll be speaking, our distinguished speakers. Helen Molesworth, Chief Curator of Exhibitions at the Wexner Center and soon to be Curator of Contemporary Art at Harvard University. Wangeshi Mutu, artist, and Ingrid Sishi, Editor-in-Chief at Interview Magazine. We are very pleased to have all of you here. I'm tremendously looking forward to what you have to say. And Helen, take it away.
Hi, everyone. Thanks to everybody. I feel like Gene Wilder in The Producers, like, when the time is on the bottom of the screen. Is there any way to turn down the light that's hitting me right in my eyes, please? Thanks. When I received the invitation to this conference, I thought that I would read a truncated version of a catalog essay that I've written for Connie Butler's upcoming WAC exhibition, which is on three artists, Joan Snyder, Mary Heilman, and Howard Dina Pindell. But I gave that paper as a lecture recently at Harvard. And I went to state school, public school, and the kids at Harvard are smarter. At the end of the Q&A, one of the graduate students in the Department of the History of Art asked me a question I couldn't answer. And I answered it badly, and the question was a question of genealogy, of now that these artists had been quote-unquote recovered and were being re-entered in some way into the canon, where did I want to see them? And I fumbled and said that I'd like to see Joan Snyder hung in a gallery of... that's not quite how I stumbled, but, you know, hey... that I'd like to see the Joan Snyder painting installed. I feel like George Bush. That I'd like to see the Snyder painting installed in a room of other modernist abstract color field painting. And, not color field, but abstract painting. And this elicited from part of the audience a surprising round of applause. And the modernist in me, or the contrarian in me, knew immediately that the answer was wrong. So instead of reading you that paper, which I actually wish I could now retract from Connie's catalog, I'm gonna try to answer that student's question. To begin with a working definition. According to Eli Zaretsky, a Marxist historian of the 1970s, feminism aspires, and I quote, to revolutionize the deepest and most universal aspects of life, those of personal relations, love, egotism, sexuality, and our inner emotional lives. I like this definition of feminism. It helps me to remember that part of what I'm after as a feminist in any number of small ways is the fundamental reorganization of the institutions that govern us as well as those we in turn govern. That being the case, thinking about the institutionalization of feminism in the museum is no small matter. I suppose that's one of the many reasons why this conference is sold out. It seems clear that feminist art history has made enormous gains. We have recovered from oblivion scores of women artists, populated the academy with female professors, established classes on feminist art practices, and entered numerous women artists into the canon, such that your average art history student would be hard-pressed to get a BA these days without knowing at least a smattering of women artists. In my experience, the museum has been slower to encompass feminism's challenges than the academy, despite the fact that the majority of its workforce is women. One example of the pervasive sexism in museums is evidenced by how slow museums of modern and contemporary art were to acquire feminist art of the 1970s. Furthermore, when they did buy it, or as is more often the case, accept it as gifts, they were often reticent to exhibit it. Indeed, much of the feminist art in permanent collections, like that of MoMA, rarely, if ever, graced the walls. For instance, I can't do 20 minutes like this, guys. Okay, I'm buying back a minute right now. Thank you. For instance, MoMA owns two terrific paintings, one by Joan Snyder, the other by Lee Lozano. The Snyder was acquired the year it was made in 1978, the Lozano much later, painted in 1963. It was acquired in 2004. The Snyder has been on view twice, once in a permanent collection exhibition of new acquisitions in 1979, and then again in a permanent collection rotation of 1987. The Lozano, acquired in 2004, has yet to be placed on public view here at MoMA. This is not to engage in the ever-popular sport of MoMA bashing, which I've partaken in and it is fun when called for. There are a million reasons why art objects languish in the vaults of museums. So rather than simply denounce the status quo, I'd like to ask some questions about the lack of visibility of feminist art production. What are the ramifications for the reception and understanding of contemporary art, given the lack of display of earlier feminist work? In other words, I'm interested in what forms of genealogy feminism can offer in the space of the museum. And more specifically, if art objects demand of their viewers various forms of competence for interpretation, then what are the exhibition conditions that the museum needs to establish to both create and satisfy those demands? In 2005, MoMA bought and quickly established a mammoth painting entitled Presentation by the young artist Dana Schutz. Schutz garnered an enormous amount of press. She was a young recent graduate of the newly hot MFA program at Columbia who made big, splashy, expressive paintings. I confess I was slow to see what is interesting about her work. My first reaction was that of the contrarian, clucking my tongue about the New York Times Magazine article about her, having a good Sunday morning soapbox rant about why no conceptual artist ever gets their picture in the New York Times. What turned me around on Schutz was threefold. I became interested in Joan Snyder's stroke paintings from the 1970s. These paintings combined a modernist grid with all of its will to silence and impartiality, with a wildly expressive brushstroke that resembled that of an impassioned censor. The combination of expressionism and its disavowal seemed to me emblematic of the feminist struggle to make the personal political. The second thing that began to turn me around on Schutz were some thoughts I had had about the importance of de Kooning for the painter Amy Silman. This is an associative chain I found profoundly counterintuitive in my own head. As a feminist trained during what now feel like the heady days of 1980s theory, I thought de Kooning was bad. I also thought painting was bad. I thought lots of things were bad. But it was clear to me that Silman didn't think de Kooning was bad, and that she had picked up on something else, the kind of frothy, pink, almost rococo side of de Kooning, far from suggesting de Kooning the misogynist or the putative misogynist. Silman's paintings suggest that in de Kooning one might find a more feminized practice of painting, in which abstraction is ineluctably linked to the decorative in a completely non-pejorative use of the term. When I saw the Schutzes again, they were in the context of an absolutely awful exhibition in London called USA Today, a show of recent American art drawn exclusively from the Saatchi collection. Rather than support the jingoistic premise of the exhibition, I found the horror of such crash nationalism during wartime a little hard to swallow. Schutz's paintings unraveled it from the inside. Her oversized, these are enormous, they're like, you know, 12 by 10 or 16 by 18 or something, they're really big. Her oversized, self-devouring figures, awash in a pukey palette, seem to encapsulate perfectly the horror of our current wartime conditions, particularly the complete obliteration of rational speech that has been a central strategy of the Bush-Cheney-Rove administration. I suppose what I'd like to try and unpack today, then, is the temporality of my double encounter with Schutz's work. Perhaps part of the unbridled popular affirmation for Schutz was that her paintings brimmed with an energy and vibrancy, what the critics always call a directness of paint on canvas, complete with a, I find, somewhat disarmingly emotional palette. So too, the images display a particularly legible kind of neurosis about power and the body. Again and again in her canvases, devouring and purging mouse, desperately spit out paint instead of food or words, in an attempt at a kind of pre- or post-linguistic form of communication. And yet, for the most part, Schutz was not discussed in the tradition of other feminist work. Rather, her newness and her youth were offered as the primary filter through which we were to approach these paintings. Part of what was appealing, in other words, was how they appeared to be unconnected to any artistic precedents. This amnesia, while prevalent in the current market-driven art world in general, is largely, however, not the case with younger male artists, who are, in fact, quickly legitimized into comfortably entrenched art historical narratives. They are almost always given fathers by their critics. This makes sense, given the fact that the average museum presents its permanent collection as an offering of pluralist harmony, one good picture after another, intermittently punctured by more Oedipally inflected narratives of influence in which sons either make an homage to their fathers, Sarah to Pollock, kill their fathers, Stella to Pollock, or simply ignore their fathers in some sort of hostile standoff. I don't know, a lot of people to Pollock. Feminist genealogies, I find, are not so clear, largely because they are structured by a shadowy absence. This is why art historians and curators have so often turned to the tasks of recovery and inclusion. And we can think here of the recent Lee Bontecue, Lee Lozano, and Joan Snyder retrospectives, as well, obviously, as the forthcoming and much anticipated WAC at LA MoCA. The work of recovery is important. I have done it myself, and I will continue to do it. However, I have grown increasingly puzzled about how one should reinsert these absences, repressions, and omissions into the narrative continuum of the museum. I know I don't want ghettoized galleries dedicated to feminist art, but where, for instance, after not exhibiting Sweet Kathy's Song and Double Hammer, should MoMA hang its Lozano and its Snyder? And I suppose this is my way of hoping that this conference is not like what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. So I offer this in humble and with humility to my colleagues at MoMA. Is it really as simple as reinserting these pictures into a chronological narrative that has hitherto not accounted for them? Lozano near Gustin, Snyder near Marden. The chronological purist in me loves this idea, but I fear it is the non-feminist in me that desires such a pat formulation to simply repair a broken story by insisting that these artists occupy their rightful place in the grand narrative. I fear this is not feminist enough. Is it a revolution of the deepest order to insert women artists back into rooms that have in fact been structured by their very absence? What would it mean instead, perhaps, to take this absence as a particular historical condition under which the work of women artists is both produced and understood? Can we imagine different forms of genealogy, hence different temporalities for thinking about feminist art production? For instance, I have a fantasy room in which hang a Joan Snyder, a Cindy Sherman, an Amy Silman, and a Dana Schutz. I have what we curators call an intuition that these works might talk to each other. We say ridiculous things when we're not at academic conferences. My first response to this fantasy is to be made incredibly nervous by its ahistorical, potentially essentializing, or pseudo-morphological nature. But recent work by art historians Lisa Tickner and Mignon Nixon have helped me anyway and may point a way out of such a chronological versus thematic impasse. Both have argued tentatively but with promise for historical models of influence, production, narration, and interpretation that eschew the two most familiar to art history, either that of the murderous son's relation to his Oedipal father, or that of the dutiful daughter learning the oral tradition sitting at her mother's knee that has been the hallmark of the mother-daughter model of artistic influence. Opting out of these enormously powerful versions of history, Tickner and Nixon look to another version of family life for models of production and reception. They look, that is, to the model of siblings and cousins. Tickner turns to the French philosophers Deleuze and Guattari's idea of the rhizome, arguing that contrary to its being a historical argument in its sort of refusal of any kind of evolutionary schema, that the current conditions of artistic production are largely such that the synchronic wins out over the diachronic. This is not always the case, of course, but it does help to understand the young woman in her studio who grows up in the halls of MoMA but doesn't see her first Joan Snyder painting until it suddenly emerges one damp morning like a mushroom under a tree at the Jewish Museum. And this moment, all right, that's you guys just X that metaphor from the paper. At this moment, does the young artist need the diachronic narrative of mother-daughter, much less that of father and son? Not gendered per se, I would argue. These structural positions, I think, are available to either gender. Or are the lines of influence and condition, are the lines of influence and the conditions of production now structured by the necessarily competing ideas of identification, attachment, sameness and difference, rejection, or just benign indifference? As Tickner writes, women may have, and I quote, the anxiety of finding oneself a motherless daughter seeking attachment, but by finding real and elective artist mothers releases women to deal with their fathers and to encounter their siblings on equal terms. Feminism fought for our right to publicly acknowledge cultural expression. It also insists on our place in the patrimony as equal heirs with our brothers and cousins. Close quote. Or in the words of Deleuze and Guattari, so aptly quoted by Tickner, and I quote now Deleuze and Guattari, the tree is filiation, but the rhizome is alliance, uniquely alliance. So what alliances are made possible by the installation I propose? What new competences do these objects demand of the viewer if placed in such a configuration of alliance to one another? Might we see in the back and forth between the forces of abstraction and representation, between expressionism and its restraint, in the highly emotional, affective use of color, a shared exploration of the non-linguistic forms of communication? Far from a universal language of abstraction, beauty, or expressionism, doesn't the non-linguistic emerge here as a kind of contested field? Over and again, these works stage a situation in which speech and language are intimated but not actualized. Whether in Snyder's censorious strokes or Schutz's proliferation of mute figures in the face of a gaping void, or Sherman's macabre aping of Hollywood and fairy tale narratives, only to find her characters forever silent despite the prominence given in the image to the mouth, or Amy Silman's cartoonish line, everywhere begging for a caption that is refused, supplanted instead by the jumble of lines and planes of color that slowly configure into figures attempting to communicate across divided planes. Perhaps the alliance is around a shared process of disavowal with regards to speech and language, an ambivalence regarding claims to self-expression as such, especially given the privilege afforded to such claims by bourgeois capitalism and patriarchy. For me, the internal dynamics of each image share a sense of pictorial struggle around and about a world structured by language, the language that we know always already precedes us, the language of painting, of abstraction, of color, of Hollywood genre, of gender, of family. And that the feminist entry into such language is not governed by acceptance or affirmation, but is rather rife with struggle, as we try to simultaneously occupy and deny the positions afforded to us in the patriarchal systems that always already precede us. My hope is that this fantasy room of artworks might help to create the conditions of viewership that would make an issue out of the psychic and social conditions under which and within which art is made by women, by feminists in the patriarchy. In closing, let me quickly return to my earlier quandary of how we might begin to create feminist genealogies in the museum. I have declined the ghettoized room of feminist art. I have refused the simple insertion of women back into canonical formations predicated upon their exclusion. My fantasy rooms suggest to me that I am also not interested in rooms where who made the work and under what conditions doesn't matter. It's important to me, after all, that the artists are women. So perhaps the idea of assembling works of art synchronically through alliance permits them to talk about what does matter in our struggles for cultural expression, in which women artists, although they might find themselves on equal footing, that of the sibling or the cousin, with their brothers, still labor under conditions that are demonstrably shaped by patriarchy, and that such conditions produced work that can be produced as such. And it occurs to me that, of course, Anne Walsh and Lorna Simpson and Mwangechi Mutu might be very interesting inclusions in this room. The art historian Mignon Nixon has also thought about the possibilities of shifting our interpretive lens away from the family drama of Mommy, Daddy, and Me, away, again, from Oedipal scenarios. She too asks us to consider the logic of siblings. For Nixon, however, siblings are not primarily a model or metaphor for alliance or equality. Rather, they constitute a recognition as traumatic as the recognition of sexuality itself. Siblings and cousins are the undeniable proof that one is serial, that one exists in a continuous chain of sameness and difference, of repetition and death. Look again at Schutz's presentation and Snyder's Sweet Kathy's song. I'd like to close on this very provisional note. Might there be a way of rethinking the notion of the sisterhood, a word so out of date it almost sounds cool to me? What if the sisterhood was not predicated on essentialist claims to gender, not dependent upon behaving as our mothers would like us to? And I'm thinking here of that acrimonious split between the 70s and 80s feminists, but also some of the mother talk that's been going on here today. What if sisterhood offered a different model? What if sisterhood offered a model of alliance that had at its core a loving but skeptical engagement with the new, such that the new is understood to be bound up with seriality and repetition, and as such defies the logic of chronological or linear history. Could such a model of interpretation of sisterhood or genealogy offer the understanding that the new does not cancel out the old, as the market, of course, wishes it does, but serves to recalibrate the alliances? Think of the moment of the new baby's arrival home. Her arrival simultaneously produces a mother, a sister, an aunt, a grandmother. Everyone's identity has shifted. In this model, temporal narratives of influence are open for the Rashomon-like effect of the voices of many nieces and nephews, cousins, sisters and brothers, for whom the aunt, the sister, the mother, and the grandmother may be one and the same person, but one's relationship to her would be infinitely different. Thank you.